Okay. So we're looking at Perek Kaf Gimel in Bereishis, Pasuk Aleph. I want to take the opportunity basically to present two ways of looking at Parshas Chayesar that the Rav developed in different contexts. I'm not going to... There were floating around the internet. There's a long shear. It's actually quite accessible. Excuse me. Hello? Okay, sorry.
Whoa, that's really cool.
What? Ah, okay. Anyways, I was saying there's a shear floating around the internet that you can hear that discusses some aspects of it, other things the Rav said on other occasions. So I'm going to try to put them together. I want to focus in on, I take the opportunity to focus in on two specific issues that emerge from the way that, two basic issues of the Rav, issues of the Rav's philosophy that that emerge from looking at the story of the sale of the of Marat HaMachpelah. So let's look at the key psukim, and then we'll go further. Vayuchay Sarah me'ah shana ve'shrim shana ve'shava shanim k'shnei chayei Sarah. She was 127 when she passed away. Vatamat Sarah b'kiryat Arba hi Chevron be'eretz Kenan. She died in Chevron. Vayavo Avraham l'spot l'Sarah. V'liv kotav. He came to eulogize Sarah, and he came to cry for her. Vayakam Avraham me'al pnei meto, vayidaber al b'nei chet lemur. And so he got up from his mourning, and he spoke to the sons of Chet, who are the Hittites. Actually, lived in southeastern Turkey. They were a major force. They had an empire that spread out all over into Syria and what later is Assyria, down into the central part of Israel. By this time, this is just a small Hittite enclave which lives in Hebron. And he says to them, "Ger v'toshav anochi machem, I am a ger and a toshav. I'm a resident alien in your midst." We'll come back to this word in a second. "Tnu li achuzat keveri machem v'ekbarameti lefanai." Give me some kind of a cemetery. I need a place to be able to bury my wife so that I can bury her. And all of them said, you're such a big shot, you're a major player, you're a sheik, you've got armies, you've got all kinds of stuff. Shema'enu Adoni, hear us, O my, our Lord. Nisi Elohim ata betochenu, you are Prince of God in our midst. B'mivchar kvarenu kvoret beitecha. You bury your dear departed in the best graves that we have available. Ish mimenu et kivro leichlevim chamikvor meitecha. None of us will prevent you from burying your dead among us. Vayakam Avraham v'yishtachol am ha'aretz lefnei chet. So Avram got up and he bowed down to them. Vayidaber itam le'mor. And so he said to them, if you really yeshet nafshachem lekbor miti lefanai, if you really really want to do this, k'shma'uni, hear me, hearken to my words. I'm speaking in fancy in biblical, sort of semi biblical Hebrew English for a reason. I want to give you a sense of the gravitas, the severity of the moment. Ufiguli be'efron ben tzohar. I want you to please entreat Ephron the son of Tzohar to come forward. V'yiten li, and he should sell me, and he should give me Marat HaMachpelah Shelo, the double cave that is in his possession, Asher B'Ktzei Sadeh, which is the end of his field. B'chesef Mali Yitnen Ali, I'll pay good money, you know, top dollar for it. B'tochachem Lachuzat Kelor. V'Ephron Yoshe B'Toch B'nei Chet, and Ephron was a member of the council of the area of he himself was no slouch. And he said, and so Ephron said to him in the eyes, in the ears, in the earshot, in the presence of his fellow countrymen, more this whole thing was taking place in the gate of the city, which is where all the major activity goes place. Did you get to Tel Dan when you're running around in the north? Up north, they've uncovered the city of Dan, which is one of the places, you know, like from Dan to Beersheba. So one of the things they did was, that was a city that was built by Yeravam, and it also had a golden calf there. The festival of the golden calf of Yeravam after he split the country in two. You guys know all what I'm talking about? Okay, it was actually the 15th of Cheshvan, which is last week. Exactly a week ago. In any event, I was doubting Mincha at Bar Ilan last week, and this older member of the faculty gets up and yells out after Mincha, "Chevre, you know what Yontif today is?" They're all going, What kind of Yom Tov is today? There's no holidays in Cheshvan. So he said, it's the fake holiday of your Rambam ben Nidbat to go worship the golden. I don't know what he was trying to accomplish by telling us that. But anyways, in any event, So if you go to Tel Dan, you'll see that they've reconstructed the area of the gate of the city, which is where the king would come out and he would judge the people, and otherwise that's where people hung. It's sort of like the Midrahov. Okay? Lo adoni shmaini, no, my lord, listen to me. Hasaden atati lecha, I give it to you. Vamarasher bo, and I give you the cave. I'll give it to you, please. Don't ask me. Don't insult me by asking for money for this. Avram lay Abad down in front of the Amharit is not ignoramus, it means the city council. And he spoke to Ephron in the presence of the council. Ach imatalushma eini. No, please listen to me. Nahatahati, I've given you. Please, here's the money. Please let me buy it, and I'll bury my departed there. And Ephron replied, "Adonish ma'ini, oh my lord, hear me. Eretz arba'a me'ot shekel kesef bin yuvecha ma'yuvet me'chak for. You know what's 400 talents of silver? I'll tell you what it is. It's a lot of money. 400 talents of silver between you and me. What's the big deal? We're both on that kind of level. And then go bury your dead." And then Ephron gave him the money and purchased the property. Now, first of all, have you done any bargaining with Arabs in the Shuk while you've been here? This is exactly the way it happens. It's how you go in, you start talking. And then you say, well, it's this. And you say, oh, no, you're my friend. I'm going to give you a deal, blah, blah, blah. And then you come back and say, no, I really can't. And he says, oh, well, what can I do? You're my friend. I can do anything you want. And I'll give it to you for this. No, I can't. Da, blah, da. Anyways, then you come down to a price or whatever. So this is classic Oriental bazaar, choreographed kind of discussions. I want to zoom in on two points here. The first point is, why did he take the first offer? Why did they want to give it to him? Why did he really need to own the property? So the rabbis say there were actually three reasons. Reason number one is that the truth of the matter is, gifts are a funny thing. They're in perpetuity. They're permanent. But by the same token, there's something not quite base. There's not something quite not established about presents. You know, I gave you a gift. It's as if you really don't really own it. You owe me. What Avraham Avinu was trying to do was to make sure that his rights to this place were absolutely irreproachable. And as a result, when you buy something with cash, that's always the better way. Now, credit, even credit is not as good. You pay with hard cash, the thing is yours, and there's no question. Interestingly, the Chumash, the Tanakh tells us three cases where hard cash was paid for property. One is Marat HaMachpelah, one is Kever Yosef, and the other one is Har Abayit. David HaMelech paid hard cash for Goren HaRavna HaYevusi, for the threshing floor of HaRavna the Jebusite, which is Har Abayit, and Yaakov bought the property which later became Kever Yosef, and Marat HaMachpelah. So Chazal say there are three places in Eretz Israel which the non-Jewish world has no arguments, gives no tithes to the Jews, that as if they don't owe them, and they are Marat HaMachpelah, Kever Yosef, and Har Abayit. The irony is, at least as far as the present circumstances are concerned, those are Dafka the three places where the Arabs Dafka zoom in and say we don't own them: Har Abayit, Marat HaMachpelah, and Kever Yosef. But all right, in any event, that was the idea. In that context, there's another reason why it was important to Avraham Avinu to have unquestionable ownership of Marat HaMachpelah. And that is because there is a concept of cemetery. Cemetery is not just a place you bury people. A cemetery is a place which is set aside. It's hard to say a place full of dead bodies who are Tomei has Kedusha, but there is sort of a sense of special status that being buried in sacred ground has for us. And you know that people make, well, I hate to say it, I don't mean to be sarcastic. Oh, maybe I didn't mean to be sarcastic. Some people make aliyah in the tourist section. Some people make aliyah in first class, and some people make aliyah in the baggage hold when they ship them off after they die to be buried here. But there is something to the idea that you're buried in sacred ground, and where the implications are for the resurrection of the dead, for Tchiyat HaMetim or whatever. It's interesting. The Rav used to tell the story that when they wanted to, when they reinterred. You know, one of the people who really helped to get the Zionist movement going and the acquisition of land to be able to cultivate and build towns and moshavim and kibbutzim on was Baron Edmund de Rothschild, who was known as Hanadiv HaYadua, the well-known philanthropist, who actually he was responsible for the creation of a lot of towns like Zichron Yaakov, which was named after his father, Maskeret Batya, named after his mother, Ramat HaNadiv, Binyamina, which is his own name. I mean, all kinds of different yeshuvim. I mean, also he was responsible, Rishon LeZion. He was responsible also for the creation of the wine industry. Carmel wineries grew out of his activities. You'll ask me, why am I draining your cup with this? Because in 1951 or 52, after the founding of the state, they decided to disinter the Baron Edmund de Rothschild from France and to bring him to be buried in Eretz Israel as a tribute to his contribution to the creation of the state. He's buried in Ramat HaNadiv, as you can imagine, a very elaborate mausoleum in a cave, actually, in Ramat HaNadiv, which is up north near Zichron. So at the time, the Rav said that Charles de Gaulle, who was the leader of the French government when they wanted to reinter the Nadiv HaYadua, they were objecting. How can you take somebody he was buried in the sacred land of France and move into Israel? And the Rav, you know, and they were trying to explain to him that this is, you know, for us, this is a special thing in terms of not just in a Jewish cemetery, but in a, but in the land of Israel. So there is something to that. More importantly, in terms of the implications of buying the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, I want to zoom in on the on Pasuk Dalet. Avraham Avinu says to the Hittites, "Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, nuli achuzat kever imachem v'kbara miti lefanai." I am a ger and I am a toshav. Now, when you think about it, what's a ger? What's a ger? What? Right. We call it a convert. We use it for convert. What is the technical meaning? What's the literal meaning of the word mean? What? It's a stranger. It's a person who's new to town. Even a convert is new to town. He's got a lot of socialization to do, never mind learning Torah and stuff like that. What's a toshav? What does the word toshav mean? It's a settler, a resident. It comes from the word leshevet. Toshavei hamakom are the residents of a specific area. So the question is, how can you be both a ger and a toshav? Either you're a stranger or you're a resident. Either you're integrated or you're not integrated. I mean, which is it, Labriu? How does it work? So the answer is, so the Rav zeroed in on this issue, on this pasuk, and said, this whole sort of choreographed negotiation between Avram and the Hittites, and the way that he said, "I will bury my dead among you," but he Dafka had to have his own burial place. He wasn't enough to bury Sarah among the Hittites. Comes to full expression in the words "ger v'toshav," because the truth of the matter is that the relationship of Jews of Avram Avinu to the community of Hebron, where he had lived for so many years, is a fundamentally, okay, we would say conflicted, contradictory, the Rav would say dialectical. Dialectical means that you have two opposites, both of which are true, okay? And you've got to deal with both of them somehow. People have love-hate relationships. What does that mean? I love them and I hate them. How can you love and hate the same person? It happens. Okay? On the one hand, Avraham Avinu was a resident of Hebron. He was a wealthy, powerful individual. He had retainers. He obviously was a guy whose wealth they respected, because Ephron comes up to him and says, "You know, what's 400 talents of silver between us? You know, we're at the high poloi. We go to the best country club there is." Avraham Avinu paid taxes, I assume. Avraham Avinu was part of the general power structure. Avraham Avinu was able to approach the council and to be taken seriously. You don't just go marching into the city council. You have to have standing. Avraham Avinu had standing. And there's no question that as a result, the Hittites, they would love to have something like of Avraham Avinu's stature, power, and money to be part of the overall structure of the country. Consider, for instance, look what happens. What happens when Yaakov goes to Shechem, and he has this terrible, terrible situation It's a terrible situation with Shechem. What happened in Shechem? No? Whoa. First, what happens?
They take Dina.
Dina goes out for a walk and she gets raped by Chamor, the son of Shechem. Okay? By Shechem, the son of Chamor. Yefet. Okay? Not Yefet. And they say, well, let the two get married. That'll make an honest woman out of Dina. And they set a condition that if you want to marry into our family, then you have to basically become Jewish. You have to accept one God. You have to be circumcised. Notice what then Chamor says to then Shechem says to Chamor, okay. Chamor says to them, my son Shechem wants to marry your daughter. Let them get married. And then he goes on. This is Perek Lamed Dalet Pasuk Tet. V'itchatnu otanu. You marry our women. Benotechem titnu lanu. We'll marry your girls. Benotechem tikhu lachem. We'll become machatanim, and we'll all become one people. Later on, okay. And later on, when Shechem and Chamor want to tell the people in Shechem that they have to become they said that we can pull off this marriage. So what's in it for Shechem except for the fact they have to go through a terrible operation? So notice in Pasuk. Kafbet. Ach bezot ye'otu l'anashim l'shevet itanu. These people will live with us. Liot l'amechad will become assimilated among us. Behimod lanu kol zachar kasher him nimulim. We have to become circumcised as they are. Miknehem v'kinyanam v'chol behem tama lo lanu hem. Ach ne'ot alehem v'yeshvu itanu. We'll get it all! We'll assimilate in all their money and all their deeds and all their hotels from Boardwalk. It's all going to be part of me. It's all going to be, they'll all be ours. All we got to do is this little operation that has to be done. Okay? What's the point? The point was, it's in the interest of the Shechemites to absorb Yaakov and to get everything they have. I don't have any doubt that this was one of the motivations behind the Hebronites trying to be so nice to Avraham, even though I'm sure they really did, you know, respect him for whatever the case might be. So he was a Toshav. He was enough of a Toshav that they wanted to make him more of a Toshav. But Avraham Avinu says, no, I'm not just a Toshav. I'm also a Ger. I don't worship your gods. I don't hold of your values. I don't believe in your morality or lack thereof. My tribe or my family has a special mission to go from God. We are supposed to stay separate, and therefore we can't just bury our dead among you. We have to have our own separate our own separate mission, our own separate concerns, and our own separate cemetery. We are Toshavim, but we're also Gerim. In the movie that we saw, you saw at the very beginning of the movie that the Rav on one occasion said, it's very simple. We are simultaneously citizens of the world. We participate, we pay taxes, we contribute to science and to math and to architecture and to the arts and to defending the right and we stuck it to Jewish and to non-Jewish and Jewish charities. We do all of these things. We do all of these things because we're Toshavim, we're part of the world. We can't separate ourselves from the world. It's a violation of our inner essence. We are Toshavim. We can't isolate ourselves from Western society or from the larger world. We are part of humanity. We are all descended from the one man. The Mishnah says that, you know, there's one reason, that the reason why there was only one man created was because so nobody ever would be able to say that my ancestors were greater than yours. At the end of the day, we're all descended from Adam Arishon, and we're all created by the one God. On that regard, there's a human agenda and human responsibilities that affect every single one of us. And we can't avoid them, we can't ignore them, and we violate something of ourselves if we do. At the same time, despite the fact things that we have in common, we are also Gerim. We have our own concerns, we have our own destiny, we have our own covenant with God, we have our own responsibilities, and that requires that we keep ourselves separate. That there are certain divides that we cannot cross, that there are certain things that we cannot do, there are certain places we cannot eat, and there are certain days that we cannot do things, because we have our own relationship with God. It has more responsibility, it has more sanctity, it has more impact. There's nothing we can do about that. We are Gerim, and we must always be alone. In fact, the Medrash, this was a Medrash that the Rav always used to like to quote a lot, and that was, why was Avram Avinu called Avram HaYivri? Why was he always called the Hebrew? Well, technically speaking, Hebrew is a determinant of certain ethnic groups. That means that Avram was part of certain ethnic groups migrated into Eretz Israel in the period. Sort of, again, ethnic identification. But Medrash says something even more deeper. He says, why was he called Ivri? Ki kol ha'olam me'ever lezeh v'hu me'ever lezeh. Avraham Avinu took on the entire world. He took on all of civilization. Everybody else worshipped idols. Everybody else had easygoing morality. Everybody else did or didn't do whatever they thought was important. We had a special relationship and therefore with God. We have a special destiny with God. We have a special mission from God. We have mitzvahs. We have a covenant with God, which I'll come back to. However the case might be, we are over on the other side. The world doesn't understand us, and we have to keep ourselves alone. That's built into the Jewish DNA. And the truth of the matter is that even when the Jews try to assimilate, in many, 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 many cases, it doesn't help anyways. It's a marvelous... this is the Rav did not quote. It's a marvelous image that expresses that. You've all heard of Woody Allen? None of you have heard of Woody Allen. Woody Allen is a comic who also has done some brilliant, some absolutely brilliant movies. You never heard of Manhattan or Bananas Sleeper or
Bananas and Pajamas?
No. Bananas or Take the Money and Run. None of these? Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. In any event, one of the movies that he did was called Annie Hall, in which this neurotic Jewish... It was this movie in Annie Hall, in which this... You know what, let me see if I can find it. Hold on. So having shown you the clip from Annie Hall, the point is that the Jew is separate, even his best efforts to stay separate are not going to help. All right, ger v'toshavani. So the Jew lives vis-a-vis the outside world. He lives, as I said, a dialectical life between being part of the outside world and being separate simultaneously, at home and never quite at home, because of his unique status. And that comes to expression already in this negotiation between Ephron and between the Hittites. That's point number one. More importantly, is the question of the relationship between Avram and Sarah. Okay. Vatamat Sarah b'kiryat Arba, hi Chevron be'eretz Kanaan, vayavo Avraham lispod l'Sarah v'livkota. He came to eulogize her and to cry. Okay, I have a question. What's wrong with that pasuk? What's wrong? What's odd? What's a hesped? What does the word hesped mean?
Eulogy.
It means a eulogy. What's a eulogy? You ever, anybody, nobody's ever been to a funeral?
Uh-huh.
So what's a eulogy?
Speak the
person. Right, and what's the function of a eulogy? What? What's its function? Right. The function of a eulogy is to objectively, not objectively, emotionally, but to clearly delineate the salient character traits of the person. You give a eulogy so people will know who that person was, especially their good points. A eulogy is there to speak good of the word. Eulogos means to speak good, good words. To talk about the tzedakah they did, or the Torah chesed they did, or the Torah that they learned, or the tzidkus that they did, whatever the case might be. That's the function of a eulogy. The function of a eulogy is to sum up a person's life in his honor, and so the people should know who the person was that's no longer here. Okay? What's Bechin? Crying. Who cries when somebody dies? Right. The people who are close to them, they're the ones, they know intuitively that somebody's died. They know intuitively who's in what their loss is. Okay? What is the closest relationship in the world? No? The closest, most intimate relationship in the world is between a husband and a wife. It's ironic. It's the one relationship that can be terminated. You can't divorce your parents, you can't divorce your siblings, and you can't divorce your children. Might want to sometimes, but you can't. But nevertheless, the Gemara says, "Ein isha meta el labala, vein baal meta el ishta." When a husband dies, or God forbid, a wife dies, the one who really, really feels it is the spouse. Okay. So I'll ask you a question. What's wrong with this pasuk? Vayavo Avraham lispod l'sara v'livkota. What's odd? Have you ever met somebody who just lost their spouse? No, that's actually lucky. A person who's just lost their spouse is totally destroyed. Okay. And yet here Avraham Avinu came, and he got up and he eulogizing. Look, I've eulogized lots of people. People I knew, people I didn't know. Okay? Eulogizing requires composure. It requires distance. It requires having all your faculties about you. There's a reason, by the way, that the minig, there's an established custom that you don't give eulogies. You never give eulogies until at least a month has gone by. Eulogies require distance. So let me ask you a question. Avraham Avinu just lost his wife. They've been married since God knows when. They've been through everything together. Periods of tension and of loss and of struggle, and she was taken away from him twice, and the crisis that must have affected them during the Akedah, and the whole business around Yishmael when she had no children, all these things, and she died. She's one of the few people in the world who remembered Avram when he was a bad boy still in Ur Kasdim. They were distant relatives. They were relatives. Isn't it strange that he was able to get up there? I mean, the Torah is telling you is that he got up there and he eulogized Sarah and then he cried. It's supposed to go the other way. First you collapse. First you cry. And then when you have some distance, then you give a eulogy. When you've calmed down a little bit. As I said, that's why there's a custom to only have eulogies after a month. You make a hesped after a month, after the shloshim. So why was it that Avraham Avinu did something which was totally, totally out of character? How could he transcend himself? In order to be able to understand this, it's necessary to understand who Sarah was. What was she to Abraham? She wasn't just his wife. Okay. What Avram and Sarah together created was what the Rav used to call the covenantal community. Covenantal community. What's a covenant? What?
Promise?
It's like a promise, yeah. It's more than a promise, actually. A covenant is a binding agreement. A covenant is something which binds people together. We talked about, what's the word in Hebrew for covenant?
Brit.
There is a Brit that binds the Jewish people to God. What are the terms of that Brit? The Torah. The Torah is the document that lays out the terms of the Brit. The initial discussion is in the Ten Commandments, where God says, "I am God. I took you out of Egypt, and now you have to do X, Y, and Z." Okay, but it's more than that. The entire Torah is the covenantal writ, and that's what binds us together. Or Rav Sajigan used to say, "Our nation is only a nation because of the Torah." What does that mean? That means because of the covenant with God and the Constitution, which makes up that the terms of that covenant, as a result, we are Jews. Otherwise, Gornish McGornish. Which means nothing with nothing. Okay? But there was another covenant. This Brit Avot. The covenant of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov that we talk about. But the truth of the matter is that that's only half the story. Because the covenant is originally the covenant which the Bnei Israel went into Egypt with. Is the covenant not just of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but of Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Now there's a Brit Avot and there's a Brit Imahot. The terms of the Brit that bound Avram Avinu to God and his family to God were terms of what? Of accepting God, accepting Kadosh Baruch Hu and denying idols and working to spread the word that there's a one God, Osho Shemayim Va'aretz, certain mitzvot, Brit Milah, according to the Gemara, davening shacharis once a day. Wait, only davening shacharis. Davening once a day, whatever the case might be. That was the covenant. And that was a revolutionary covenant because nobody believed in only one God. Everybody believed in a million zillion gods. If you go to, on the contrary, you considered them not in the worst way if you thought you only had one God. There is a, we talked about the Pantheon once, I don't remember. In Rome, opposite the Trevi Fountain, there's this huge, unbelievably, let me see if I find a picture, this huge, really cool building. And the building is called the Pantheon. The Pantheon was built by a friend of Augustus Caesar, whose name was Marcus Agrippa, and it was built to be a home for all the gods that are worshipped in Rome. Okay, let me get the pictures. Its function, as I said, its function was to serve as a there it is. Okay? You see, there's a dome here. Okay? If you go inside, there's zillions of little niches inside where you just put a little, everybody had a little god, you put one in there, and all the gods that are worshipped in Rome were going to be covered by the pantheon. Okay? And everybody felt like, oh, it's my god, your god. We all sort of like, we worship all the gods together, and sometimes they have the same god and they have different names. Everybody's cool. Only the Jews weren't cool. Because we took on everybody else. Just like we take on everybody else in terms of temporary mores and morality as well. That was enough of a Brit, that was enough of a covenant, that was enough of a job to do, even without 613 mitzvahs. And it was a job because it was done for the greatness of mankind, okay, that Avram and Sarah were partners, they were partners in that covenant. Rashi says at the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, so that after God says, get your family out of Haran, and so God says, so the Torah says, Vayikach Avram et Sarai ishto. Avram took his wife Sarai, Velot ben Achiv, and his nephew Lot, Ved kol rechusham asher rachashu, and all of their wealth, Ved hanefesh asher rasu b'Haran, and all of the souls. Okay, that they made in Haran, vayetzu lalechet arza Kna'an, and they left to go to Canaan, and they arrived in Canaan. What do you mean, you made people? What kind of people do you make? A nefesh asher asu b'Haran? So Rashi says, the Targum says this also, shehichnisan tachat kanfei ashchina. In other words, these are the people who joined Avram Avinu, already in Haran, in the worship of the one God, in the belief in the one God. Which endangered their lives too. People looked at him at best as weird. And for the people who believed in all these gods, they figured that their gods were going to be mad at them. Because Avram Avinu was telling people these gods are baloney, they're nothing. And only the one God counts. And you can be sure the people in Haran, and before that, people were, because they were more than happy to see them go. It says, Rashi, Shichnisan tachat kanfei ashchina, Avraham megayeret ha'anashim, v'sagisara megayeret ha'anashim. Avram was Megayer the men, and Sarah was Megayer the women. And the Torah considered it as if they had created them, because they became transformed personalities. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean this was not like separate seating at a lecture in taxes. Simply, Avram and Sarah were different personalities. And what the kind of approach that certain men required is if not that women required. But they were of equal worth. They were of equal value. One can't exist without the other. They were two complementary personalities creating the Jewish people. And the truth of the matter is that, as the Rav pointed out, I'm going to read you a passage. The fact is that the same is true of today. In other words, the Torah is not a misogynist religion. It's not an anti-women relationship. That presumes that women are considered to be not in the same power as men. That's not true. In both creation stories, either man and woman are created equal, they're the same, they're just separated, they're both two sides of the same entity, or they're integrated and come out of the same thing, and one is empty without the other. There are two modalities. So just because men and women might fill different functions, but axiological point of view, from the point of view of value, the Rav used to make a point that in fact the two are of equal accord. I'm going to read you a couple of paragraphs from a eulogy that the Rav wrote for his Machatanista, his son-in-law's mother, the Rebbetzin of Taln, and he wrote as follows. People are mistaken in thinking that there is only one Masorah and only one Masorah community. That means tradition. The community of the fathers. It's not true. We have two Masorot, two traditions, two communities, two Shalshala Ota Kabbalah, the Masorot community of the fathers and that of the mothers. The Torah says, thus thou shalt say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, Beit Yaakov is the women, that's why the schools are called Beit Yaakov, Bnei Israel are the men. Okay, here it says in Mishlei, Shema b'ni musar avicha v'alti tosh torati mecha. You have musar avicha on the one hand and torati mecha on the other. The teaching of your father and the teaching of your mother. Okay, what is the difference between these two masorot, the traditions? What is the distinction between musar avicha and torati mecha? Let us explore what one learns from the father and what one learns from the mother. One learns much from father. How to read a text, the Bible or the Talmud. How to comprehend, how to analyze, how to conceptualize, how to classify, how to infer, how to apply, etc. One also learns from father what to do and what not to do, what is morally right and what is morally wrong. Father teaches the son the discipline of thought as well as the discipline of action. Father's tradition is an intellectual moral one. That is why he's identified with Musar, which is the Musar, which is the biblical term for discipline. What, on the other hand, is Torati Mecha? What kind of Torah does the mother pass on? I admit that I'm not able to define precisely the Masoretic role of the Jewish mother. Only by circumscription am I able to explain it. Perhaps permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked, and I happened to overhear. What did she talk about? I must use an halachic term in order to answer this question. She talked me in Yana Dioma. In other words, she would talk about the context of the content of the holidays. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her write or recite her prayers. I used to watch her recite the Sidra every Friday night, and I still remember the nostalgic tune. I learned from her very much, and she was a very, very learned woman. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and a warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless, dry, and insensitive. The laws of Shabbat, for instance, were passed on to me by my father. They are part of Musar Avicha. The Shabbat, as a living entity, as a queen, was revealed to me by my mother. It is a part of Torat Imecha. The fathers knew much about Shabbat, the mothers lived Shabbat, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. The fathers taught generations how to observe Shabbat, mothers taught generations how to greet the Shabbat, and how to enjoy her 24-hour presence. In other words, without Torat Imecha, without Sara Imenu, Judaism would be a bunch of dry, emotionless, mechanical rules. It was Torat Simecha that started with Sarah that drew sensitivity and emotionality and spirituality. The two could not exist without the other. That's what Avraham Avinu was faced with when he learned that Sarah died. First of all, he was two people. On the one hand, he was the head of an entire clan, the head of an entire movement, the head of a new faith, the head of a Brit. On the other hand, he was a bereaved husband. His world had just been destroyed. His best friend had just died. I am sure that every bone in his body just wanted to just collapse. And just leave me alone. I don't want to say anything. I can't move. I'm paralyzed. But his role as the head of the community demanded, just like Torat Imecha and Torat Avicha, the Brit Avot that they created together, Brit Avot V'Imahot, I should say, to spread the word of God everywhere, to take on the world, so that role required that he get up there, and before he lets himself go and indulges his own grief, he had to get up there and tell the world what it had lost. And that's what a hesped is for. This was an incredible act of heroism. To be able to sit on your emotions, to hold back your emotions while you're ready to collapse, and to talk, though in a way that was accessible and comprehensible, Because this great woman had died, not just my wife, this person who's transformed humanity. And he did it. Vayavo Avraham l'spod l'sarah v'livkota. After he finished the eulogy, and everyone else was crying and understood what exactly had happened, not just to him, but to them and to the future of the Jewish people, then he could sit down and let himself go into his private grief. There's one last confirmation of this, which nobody else noticed that I could see before the Rav pointed it out. What's the next thing in the parsha that Avraham Avinu does after he buries Sarah? No. What does he do? No? What does he do? He goes and he calls Eliezer and he says, you got to get what? A wife for Yitzchak. What will finding a wife for Yitzchak accomplish? At that point, it will guarantee the continuity of the covenantal community, continuity of the Jewish people. He will have children, and that will guarantee that the line goes on, and the belief in when God goes on, and the mission of the Jewish people goes on. Okay? Avraham Avinu lives on for another 30, 40 years. Aside from the fact that he marries somebody named Keturah, who, according to Chazal, is Hagar, and he has more children, we know absolutely nothing about what he did. The Torah says that in Perek Kafhei, he married Keturah, he had other children, he sent them all away, he made Yitzchak was his heir, and he died. What do you see from that? You see from this that after Sarah died, and he managed to find a wife for Yitzchak, Avraham, even though he lived for another 30, 40 years, Avraham's mission in life was over. He could not continue to be the Av Hamon Goyim. He could not continue to be the head of the Jewish people, of the Brit Avraham, without his beloved Sarah. Same way that the Rav describes his mother, is that if she had not taught him, he would have been a soulless being. Without Sarah, he was a soulless being. The Brit Avot, without a Brit Imahot, cannot exist. So Avraham Avinu just lived his life out, did nothing that was worth remembering. And when his time came, he died. But in the real sense, he died when Sarah died. Because without his beloved Sarah, his mission in life, his purpose in life, was over. So when he was l'spod l'sarah v'livkota, he was really not just eulogizing Sarah, he was eulogizing that special power couple, part of himself, which had also died, and which marked his departure from the historical stage.